Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with stars, creators, industry leaders, and puppet masters on Broadway and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to three of the artists behind Life of Pi. Maybe you've read the Booker Prize-winning novel or seen the Oscar-winning film about a young man's 227-day odyssey adrift on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger. When a new stage adaptation opened on the West End in London in 2021, it made a big splash, winning 5 Olivier Awards, including Best Play. Now, Life of Pi has come to Broadway, where audiences in New York can marvel at how a team of human actors and puppeteers bring to life a zebra, a hyena, an orangutan, and, of course, a ferocious Bengal tiger with the unlikely name of Richard Parker. Fresh off the Broadway production's opening night last week, three members of the creative team are in the virtual studio with me to reveal how the show's magic is made. Here's playwright Lolita Chakrabarty, puppet designer and movement director Finn Caldwell, and puppeteer Fred Davis.
Hi, Lolita, Fred, and Finn. Thanks for joining me.
Hi.
Hey. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. I wonder if we could start out just talking about the origin of the piece. Lolita, let's start with you. How did the idea of adapting Life of Pi for the stage come to you? What was it brought to you, or was it something that came to you as a creative idea?
Yes, it was brought to me. So the producer, Simon Friend in England, had the rights for the book and asked if I'd be interested in doing it. And I'd loved the book when I read it in 2002. So without really thinking through the logic of how I was going to do it, I said yes.
Had you seen the movie?
I had. I'd seen the movie when it came out in 2012, but I hadn't seen it again, which was quite useful, actually, because I wanted to base the whole thing on the book.
Yeah. What do you remember responding to either your first read in the novel or seeing the movie, or then later when you reread it with the idea of adapting for the stage?
What I loved about the novel, it made me laugh, and it made me laugh at religion in a respectful way. You know, that Jan Martel was talking about what should you believe and how do you believe and what's the logic of choosing a different religion. And the way he dealt with it was really charming, and I liked that. But also the wonder of it. It's a book full of questions and no easy answers. And I really loved that. And after reading it, I felt... Definitely, I had lots of questions, like I said, but I didn't feel frustrated by the book, which I think is its charm. You don't come out going, "What happened? I don't understand." You know, you kind of go, "Oh, there are these two stories. Which one do I choose to believe?"
Yeah. Were puppets always part of the concept? Was there ever a version of this where the animals are played by, you know, humans doing physical work in more traditional kind of costume elements?
I think we had an early joke before Finn joined us of actors in a onesie, you know, somebody playing a tiger in a onesie. But no, since Finn joined us, there was no thoughts of that at all.
Right. Yeah. And so then as you went back and sort of thought about it for the stage, what do you think makes it a good fit for a theater piece?
I think it requires a lot of imagination. And it's become very clear to me, especially after the pandemic, where we were performing in theatres with no audience, how important the audience is as a character in the play. And actually, if we say we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in the middle of a stage in London or in New York or wherever, Boston, wherever we are, the audience believe us. So it's a fantastical story that requires the audience to participate. So I think it's naturally... it's challenging, that's for sure, but it lends itself to being theatre.
Yeah. And so how did you, tell us a little bit about how, I guess, at what point, Lolita and Finn, did you two start talking in terms of what puppets were able to do, how you could, like, I just wonder about the interplay of how the designing of the puppet advanced alongside the sort of development of the script.
Well, I guess Max introduced Lolita and I, because Max had worked with both of us before. And I think Max and Lolita are already talking about this adaptation. And having done puppets with Max before, he was like, I think we should try it with puppets. And so he brought us in. But then Lolita and I got on really well straight away. And I started making stuff and was reading her stuff. And straight away, we had this brilliant thing where we were able to just talk in the room. And we're both very interested in the other's process. And so, I mean, certainly from my point of view, Lolita, it felt very generous and very open. And we went at it. We went at this really, really complicated, difficult thing for quite a long period of time and just really listened to each other. Like, oh, this bit can be told by puppetry. This bit is clearly text. This bit is projected on the stage. So it was a real collaboration of where the narrative is living in any given moment. And I think hopefully that comes across in the play, because it still feels very much like we very fluidly pass the storytelling from character to character and also from visual to the textual. Mm.
And Finn, how do you describe the design of these puppets? What kind of inspirations are they drawing on? What kind of traditions? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so Nick and I, who's not on the call, but Nick Barnes, yep, and I designed the puppets. And the first thing we do, or we think about, is what is this sort of big ask of the puppet in the show? What are we being asked to do with this puppet in this show that is different to any other show? And that's a wonderful part of my job, because I always get to reinvent and bring something new. And what the biggest ask, and there's many in this show, because the tiger has to be kind of what I would call a universal puppet. It can pretty much do anything. It can climb upstairs. It can swim. It can, you know, can do anything. But the big ask that we hadn't really definitely done before in theatre in my practice was really making a frightening puppet, puppet that would frighten the young actor playing Pi and would frighten the audience on his behalf. So it had to be scary. And that brings us into lots of things. There's the sculpture, of course, you know, big long teeth, scary eyes, dynamic snarls, but there's also the quality of the movement. And so the first thing when I was talked to by Max and Lolita about coming in was talking to Fred, who's one of the best puppeteers I know. And
we've worked with him before.
Yeah, many, many times.
Yeah.
And in fact, we met when Fred was quite young. And but Fred and some of the other great puppeteers working on it were able to give it the speed and the dynamic quality, which made it really feel like, oh yeah, okay, if we let this tiger make contact with the boy, it's going to kill him. And in a way, solving that big problem for me at the crux of it, like, can we make the puppet scary? Can we make the puppet a real threat for the boy? And then everything else flowed from that in a way. So the aesthetic design came from, we were thinking about Pi, because Lily's written this amazing framing device where Pi is recounting the whole story from the hospital. So I had imagined he's sitting on the boat surrounded by the flotsam and jetsam of the ruined ship, and you have floating bits of driftwood and rope, and in his mind he's assembling these puppets, this imagination, this memory from what he sees around him. So that was our sort of aesthetic starting point. We've come a long way and gone around many corners since then, but basically the idea holds true.
It was so interesting because it's very different from something like Warhorse, which I feel like felt more kind of skeletal, whereas I feel like the puppets that in the show feel there's a sort of striation to them and a kind of musculature to them that feels like a very different different.
I was lucky enough to be in the original production of Warhorse, and I directed versions of that around the world, but I never designed the puppets. I love those puppets because what they do brilliantly is allow the audience to more actively take part in completing the image. But what we've done in this show is, I see it as an evolution. I love Handspring. I hope they won't mind me saying that. But I see it as an evolution of the lessons we learned, both on Warhorse, but also on shows that Nick and I have made together, like A Dog's Heart, which we made with Theatre de Complicité, as an opera. Yeah. And in that, we had a large dog, and it was very elastic. So everything was, rather than Warhorse, where things are quite mechanical and blocky and fixed, we were using a lot of bungee. And we went further with that in this process to make the cat. Because I was looking at cats, I've got a domestic cat, which I absolutely love. And He is like a giant accordion, really. So in jumping, he can seem this long. When he's sat down, he can seem this long. So I was really trying to experiment with the sections of the tiger's body and the bungee that holds it all together so that it can expand and contract. So that it has, even though its surfaces are hard, there's so many of them and they're all interconnected in such an elastic way that, like wobbling a solid pencil in your hand, I don't know if you've ever done that trick, we can make something solid look elastic and fluid.
One of the things that Finn hasn't mentioned is that idea of driftwood. All the pieces of the animals are reminiscent of driftwood, and so they're not necessarily finished. So although they're beautifully painted in the colours of the animal, you get that feeling that they've been put together from detritus from the sea. It just goes right to the heart of every bit of the design. It's really clever.
Yeah. And how do you decide how many puppeteers it takes to create a particular animal?
There's a standard rule for the type of puppetry. I should let Fred answer that, really. But I'll say the technical thing. Yeah. There's a standard rule for what we do, which is contact puppeteers who are in contact with the thing you're operating. You might say inspired by Bunraku. People were saying that for quite a long time. That's a Japanese art form where they are physically holding human figures. But it's better called contact puppetry. You're in contact with the thing you're holding. What that means is that you don't want a lot of people around that, because the more you have, the more muddy the image becomes. But if you think that any mammal has 6 points of contact, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the other one, 6.
Yeah, he's pointing to, just for listeners, because this is an audio.
Oh, yeah,
it's two hands, two arms, feet, and the top of your head, yeah? And the heart, yeah.
Yeah, and that makes 3 pairs of hands. So if you want any mammal to be fully articulated, you're usually looking at 3 people. Whenever we can, we'll drop that down to less. People just thin out the bodies on stage. So the hyena is only 1 person, the hyena is 2 people, the goat is 1 person.
Yeah.
But the less people you have on it, the less articulation.
Right, I see.
And through part of it was trial and error. We started with 3 people, 3 puppeteers in the show, in the workshops in Sheffield. And that worked for the length of run that we had in Sheffield. It was only a few months of doing that show 7 or 8 times a week, and we taught several of the acting company how to puppeteer, and to, you know, a very good standard. That it was extraordinary. But by doing that for that length of time, we realized that we were going to need more puppeteers to be able to rotate through those animals to prevent as much injury from repetitive strain as possible. And to spread the load of that work, because the puppets are beautifully built, but also carry a certain amount of weight. They're not particularly heavy in themselves, but, you know, if you ask someone to hold a glass of water out with their arm outstretched for 1 minute, it's not so bad. But for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, it's quite difficult. We expanded then to 6 puppeteers in the London production, which then grew to 8 puppeteers by the end of that production. And so we've started out with 8 puppeteers in America on this leg of the journey, because we've realized that seems to be the minimum safe amount of puppeteers to have for a long run of this show with this many puppets and moving parts.
And that's interesting. I mean, that's interesting in 2 ways. First of all, Fred is skating over the fact there that the three puppeteers, Fred, Kate, and Owain, in Sheffield, did everything. I mean, they taught it to some of the actors as well, but they were doubling up on some of the characters. That's incredible. But also, it's really hard, as you can imagine, to persuade producers to pay for you to double up on the cast. They're in the show all the time. And it's a real testament to how much Simon Friend and the producers here in America have listened to the art form of puppetry and what's needed to take on board that there is no way that Fred could do 2 months of 8 shows a week or 3 months. And so to accept that this is what the show takes. And I'm really grateful for that, especially in terms of just the art form of accepting what's needed to make some really kick-ass puppetry.
Fred, tell the listeners what is your physical role in the show? I know you're one part of Richard Parker the Tiger, but are there other things? And what part of the Tiger do you play? Can you talk us through a little bit? It's kind of what a night in the show is like for you.
Yeah, of course. So on one, we have two or three puppetry tracks that we do, each of the puppeteers. One heavy track, one light track, one medium track, and one light track. Mm-hmm. My heavy track, my sort of main track, is I puppeteer the tiger's head and body. So I'm outside of the tiger puppet with one hand on a rod out the back of the tiger's head and one hand on a rod out the back of the tiger's body. Mm-hmm. There are two other puppeteers on the tiger, one person inside the tiger puppeteering a bent double, holding on to the front hands.
Yeah, I would have thought that was the heavy one. If I were going to guess, I would have called that one the heavy one, because that actor, that performer, spends the whole time bent over like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that is the hardest part of the tiger to do.
He's had a quick go at it, haven't you?
I've had a quick go at it, and I've spent a lot of time around a lot of puppeteers who've done all three parts, and that is the one that is the most taxing, I believe. Mm. That's the heart puppeteer, and then the hind puppeteer is also outside of the tiger, behind the tiger, in charge of both back legs via two rods again, and the tail, which generally hangs over their shoulder. Yeah. But there are many puppets, but I'm part of the hyena, where I'm mm-hmm. I'm inside the hyena, similar to the tiger heart. I puppeteer the giraffe at the beginning mm-hmm. of the show, some butterflies, mm-hmm. some fish, the orangutan's feet, the zebra's head, and heart, and the turtle. It's a whole menagerie of animals that we've got in the show.
Yeah. I'll have more with these three artists from Life of Pi right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
And now, here's more with playwright Lolita Chakrabarty, puppet designer and movement director Finn Caldwell, and puppeteer Fred Davis. Lolita, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, once it became clear to you what the puppets were able to do and how, and the ways in which the puppeteers could sort of bring these characters to life and kind of reveal their, you know, the emotional life of these animals as well. Well, how did that influence how your script developed?
Oh, it completely influenced it. I mean, it was because obviously the people in the play speak and the animals speak in a different way. But that doesn't mean they're not communicating. And so every beat of what how the animals change in the scene has to be incorporated into the writing so that the people who are speaking are changed at the end and we can see what the beats are with the animals. So I work really closely with Finn and Fred and with the other puppeteers to just work out what's happening to the animal at this point and how do we express that through language and through description, I suppose, so that everybody knows what's going on in the scene. I remember we in Sheffield we watched I think you showed us a video, Finn, of a pregnant zebra that was attacked by a pack of hyenas. And I remember going to London Zoo to do some research about animals, and they said, "Oh yeah, a zebra is not predator, is prey. So that if they're attacked, they just try and hide, even in sort of." When there's nowhere to hide, they just stop and stand there trying to hide. And so this video that we watched was pretty brutal, and the zebra did exactly that. It tried to hide in broad daylight as these hyenas attacked it. But in watching that, you get so much detail about the personality of a zebra and what it will do. So when the zebra is hurt on the boat with a broken leg, it is prey. And the hyena is there and the animals are there. Who's threatening it? And how would it respond? How would Pi respond to the zebra? There are so many different lines of communication that all need to be written into the play.
Right, yeah. And how does, I guess this is probably a question mainly for Fred, how much of what you do as a puppeteer is finely honed like clockwork? And then how much of it does, how much is there room for kind of impulse or kind of interpretation? Like how much are you allowed to have an acting performance as you're, you know, executing all this sort of technical stuff?
Well, it's an interesting mix of the two. It's a delicate balance. You have to have everything down like clockwork at the beginning so that you have a solid groundwork to play from. If you don't know exactly what you need to be doing at every point as a character, where you've got a hit on the stage and at what point within the scene with your other puppeteers who are performing that character, everything starts to slightly fall apart. But once you do have that down, there is a huge amount of room for play and a huge amount of room to make different acting choices as that character every scene, every night. And it's an interesting different mix of characteristics that come out of the tiger depending on which puppeteers are performing it. Because at the end of the day, we're three different people giving our own spin on the character, even though we're all aiming for the same thing, we're all going to be coming at it with different, slightly different ideas. So the characteristics of the tiger that come across, depending on who's performing it, are very different. We had an old team and a young team in London, old tiger and a young tiger, because there was only about 6 or 7 years difference between the three in one team and the three in the other. But seeing it suddenly on stage, you saw that one tiger was slightly more cantankerous and grouchy, and the other one was slightly more, you know, playful and vicious. And it was it's a really fun dynamic to be able to play like that with three people on one character, and then again, particularly with the Pi, against the Pi, because we spend so much time interacting with them in the latter half of the story. But yeah, there's a lot of acting play to be had.
The physical action, I always think, is like the text. So they learn the text, and then how they deliver that text is different every night.
And then in terms of Finn, one of the things you do, one of the co-directors of the movement of the puppetry, I wonder if you could just, and Lolita alluded to this for a minute, just about how you research, how much of what you do is research on, you know, real life animals, and then how much is, I don't know, sort of puppetry magic or tricks that make things seem alive, and like what's the mix there?
Oh wow, yeah. Okay, well, both of those things are huge. So first of all, there's two tasks before we start even rehearsing, really, on this show and on most shows I work on. We have at least a week, and I keep thinking we should have more, of just puppetry training, where the puppeteers are just learning to move the objects around. Because otherwise, if we all start on day one, they won't be able to move, even walk as the characters, or move around efficiently. So we just do a bit of puppetry technique. Of course, we talk about acting in that time too, but mainly what we're doing is getting them to a place where we can start, and I do mean start, talking to the puppets like we talk to actors. Hyena, can you go over there, please? As opposed to Fred and Scarlett, can you work out how to get into the hyena to go over there? Then we do that working out in advance. So there's this, and that is then we get a week of solid of that, and then throughout the rehearsal process, we're constantly working on puppetry technique, nothing to do with animals, just. And because each puppet that we build requires different technique, different muscle control, different whatever to operate it, to bring it to life. And then alongside that, we're doing a separate activity, but of course they're very linked, which is research into real animals. And we will look into books. YouTube is hugely helpful. The zoo, love going to the zoo. And we did that quite a bit with Warhorse, but because all of these animals are in the wild in such extreme situations, and YouTube is now so, you know, they capture everything. Videos tend to be more our friends. I wish we could see things more in the wild, but we do go for that. And then we will start to begin to understand why the animals make this noise, why the animals do this move, why the animal behaves that way to another animal. And then we will take that information and then we'll go in our show at this point, this animal is feeling under threat from this animal, for instance. What do we know about what this animal does when it feels under threat? And we'll go to our research and we'll go, well, it could do this or this or this. And we'll try that. And we'll go, that one looks really good. Okay, this one, we're going to try this one. This is exactly what it would do in the wild. And it does not read for anything on stage. We won't do that. We'll pick another one. And actually, in the circumstance that Alita's talking about, with the zebra, we had to do a third thing, not puppetry technique, not animal research, but we had to just make it theatrical. So when the hyena, sorry, spoilers, but when the hyena is ripping off the zebra's leg, we have to have the zebra scream. Because if it just goes silent, which is what we learned they do in the real world, the audience just think, have they stopped acting? Or they, you know, the audience don't know enough about zebras to accept that specific reality. So in that specific moment, we go into a third territory, which is slightly fudging it to make the audience understand the theatrical story.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, as you mentioned, it's not just the physical work that you're doing. There's also vocalizing that the puppeteers do at key moments. Yeah. That seems a little bit like impression work. What's that like, Fred?
Yeah, I mean, that also takes an incredible amount of time. And I don't think we're definitely not done with that work now. It's still an ever-evolving thing because we're constantly striving to make the same noises that these animals make. And our vocal capacity is completely different. Our lungs are different sizes. Our vocal cords are built differently. It's a constant struggle and joy and game to twist and contort our voices into making the noises that they make. The tiger in particular, because it's got to be so low at some points and so high and raspy at other points, we do a lot of layering sounds. So one of us will make quite, you know, give a bass to the, say a roar, for example. One of us will give a bass, one of us will give a sort of mid, and one of us will give more of a hiss. To sort of simulate what a tiger can do on its own. But actually, with some of the animals, we did have to, similar with the movement and the visual, we had to employ, we had to make up what they, the noises that they would make in certain situations. Like orangutans are very quiet beings, but if we had a very quiet orangutan for the duration of its time on stage, it wouldn't have had the same impact or believability as it would needed it to. And so we had to take sounds that we've heard them, we heard them make in videos and documentaries, and manufacture what those sounds meant for us in our world, for that orangutan to be making real orangutan noises, but to be making them more frequently or for different reasons than they would in the wild.
Yeah.
Are you going to say something?
Well, we also talk a lot about, a good example is the bleating of the goat. The goat gets killed in the first scene. The bleating of the goat is, I mean, goats can make loads of noises, but anywhere from sort of to you know, but what, and they're just repeating that noise really. But the goat goes from a state where it's playful to the state where it knows it's going to be killed. So we were talking to a lot of the puppeteers about, that's the noise you have. How do you make that noise go from to distress, and what can you do to that sound and where you place it in your body to take the accurate sound and give it an emotional quality, a changing emotional quality.
Yeah.
Harder with the tiger.
Yeah.
Give them a roar, Fred. Your roar is amazing.
Oh, God.
He's a bit ill.
Okay. I hope I don't make you ill by doing this right now.
That is, yeah, I wish the listeners could see how little your mouth actually moves while you're doing that. It's all in the back of your throat, it seems like. That's amazing. Lolita, now that you've lived with the show for a while, you know, you talked about the premiere in Sheffield in 2019 and it was in the West End and starting in 2021. How do you feel like the theater version delivers the story differently from the previous versions that existed? What do you think rises to the fore in this version that is different from other versions of the story?
Gosh. Well, I always think that the book is a very personal experience. It's you sitting on your own, imagining the story. I reread the book recently after a couple of years and was struck by how differently the story is told. You know, it sort of starts with 80 pages of philosophy about religion with the older Pi, who has survived and is 35 and in Canada. And then the actual shipwreck is almost incidental in the middle of the book happens, and this boy is at sea and thinking about God and trying to survive. And then this last 20 pages at the end is the Japanese shipping officials coming to find out what happened and not getting any satisfying answers. So when I look at the book, I think, oh, how did I come up with this structure? Yeah. You know, so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, really. And the film is so beautiful, but very literal, because we're looking at the pictures. I guess you get immersed in a different way, but it's easy just to sort of stand outside it and experience it rather than engage with it. So our version, I feel like it asks you to come with us as we investigate, as the Japanese shipping official, Mr. Okamoto, and I've changed the other shipping official to a Canadian diplomat in Mexico. And they both come to work out what happened to the ship that sank and who is this boy? And so the detective trail, we ask you to come and find out with us and discover it with us. So I hope it's a more immediate experience, I think, where you're feeling and engaging and, you know, like when Fred's roaring there, you're sort of really in it and feeling the fear of the animals and this boy against them, that it's a much more visceral and present experience.
Mm, yeah. And what for Fred and Finn, how has this experience, has it given you ideas for what might come next for you in terms of the kind of stories you want to tell or the ways in which you might tell them using puppetry that you maybe not exactly like the ways you've done before?
Yeah, hugely. I mean, I've been doing puppetry for quite a long time, and I guess I learned on Warhorse that if you make the puppet the central character and you put on it the requirements that you would place on an actor, suddenly the audience become much more interested. So if you treat it in a, whether it's for a kid's show, a family show or an adult show, if you treat it with the rigor that you would ask an actor to put into a story, then they suddenly become much more exciting. And I think we've gone even further with that with Richard Parker. And the fact that the industry in the UK at least turn around and we weren't thinking about it, but suddenly, you know, Fred won Best Supporting Actor with the other six puppeteers and we got nominated for choreography. We won the design set and puppetry. And so the fact that the industry is really sitting up and taking notice felt really, really honouring and humbling, actually. And of course, you know, enjoyably, I'm feeling proud about it. But it also made me think, oh my God, there is so much more, I think, that puppetry can offer. And I think particularly what I realized is I've loved making, like, probably the favorite show I've ever made. But it is also slightly within the format of these animal puppet animal shows that we've made before, like Warhorse. I mean, I think Life of Pi is certainly the best one I've ever seen. But I'm really excited to see what can be done with the human form in puppetry. We've got a bunch of shows which line up. I'm hoping Fred will join me on, that explore the human form as a thing in puppetry. Yeah.
I think it's definitely opened my eyes to what can be possible, and opened my brain to keep exploring how far we can push it with puppetry and object manipulation and lifting and projection and stage magic and stagecraft. It's the show as a whole has been a process of breaking glass ceilings in my expectations of of theatre and what can be shown. So yeah, I'm just really excited to see what comes next and keep making magic. I feel very lucky to be able to do that as a job.
Yeah. Well, we will look forward to seeing what is next from all three of you. But in the meantime, we here on Broadway can enjoy Life of Pi, which is in previews now and will be opening at the end of the month. That was Lolita Chakrabarty, Finn Caldwell, and Fred Davis, three of the artists behind Life of Pi, now on Broadway. If you enjoyed this conversation and others we've done here on Stagecraft, I'd be so grateful if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes and subscribe at all the pod purveyors, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.